birthday party?
Then you got a freaking miracle. There you go.
Welcome to the Abracadam Podcast, and I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician, Danny Whitson. Like always, Abracadamits, I hope you're getting stuff done, son. I hope you guys had a fantastic Halloween. We enjoyed ourselves. We had a good Halloween. I am now looking forward to the next holiday. No, not Christmas. Not yet. I'm looking forward to Thanksgiving. Yes, I can't wait for Thanksgiving. Last year, we didn't even make a turkey. We made a duck. Yes. And that duck was absolutely amazing. Think about going to do a duck again. Yes. Going to make a duck. I guess that's what you do as you get older. You fantasize about food and you fantasize about Thanksgiving. So, anyways, I would like to give some show dates real quick. Well, at least one I want to give an announce real quick. November 13th. I am going to be in Mooresville, North Carolina. That's just north of Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm going to be at Victory Lanes at the Wobbly Butt Lounge. You'll be able to see me and the very funny Jazz Gill there November 13th, Saturday, coming up soon. So if you are in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, you would like to see a great show, I highly suggest you come out and see me and Jazz. So I've seen both of us perform before, and it's pretty good, pretty good. But anyways, let's get right into this. Let's give a big shout out for the sponsors for today's podcast. This episode is also brought to you by Will's Towing, located at 2081 Oak Ridge Turnpike, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Now, guys, no one likes to be broke down on the side of the road. It's awful. It sucks. But don't panic. If this does ever happen, give Will Roberts a call at 865-272-5300 and let Will Roberts take care of your towing needs. Will will come pick it up, and he will park that car anywhere you need him to park it. If you want that car set in your living room, Will will put it in your living room. Also, we've all seen those tow truck drivers that show up, and they look kind of sketch. You know, like they may have been touching a possum before they came up to you. You know what I mean? One of those guys. You never have to worry about that at Will's Towing. Everybody who works at Will's Towing is clean, safe, and very friendly to deal with. So if your car breaks down, you need a towing service at all, give Will Roberts a call at Will's Towing. That's 865-272-5300. Okay, now today's guest is somebody who doesn't lack talent at all. He is an amazing sideshow performer, and he's an actor. And the cool thing is, the movie that he's best well known for, I'm sure you've seen before. It's a Tim Burton film called Big Fish. Excellent movie. I love it. But what's even more cool, it's my best friend Jason's favorite movie. So when I saw a chance that I could get this guy on the podcast, I had to jump on it. And thank God he said yes, because this guy is one of the sweetest human beings you'll ever meet and has some very interesting stories to tell. So if you will, Abracadamits, sit back and relax and enjoy my fun conversation with George MacArthur, a.k.a. George the Giant. All right, I'm excited. We've got George the Giant here on the Abracadam Podcast. How you doing, George?
Doing good. How are you tonight?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Well, first of all, I'm super excited that you came on the podcast. But if you don't mind, will you go ahead and introduce yourself to the listeners?
I am George the Giant. My real name is George MacArthur, but I've been going by George the Giant for 30 years. I've performed all over the United States and Canada and Turkey, doing old-time sideshow. I've appeared in a handful of movies and TV programs doing the weird and the strange.
Well, let's just talk about it right off top, because I got to say this, and I want to get right into it. My best friend, Jason, his favorite movie is Big Fish, and you just happen to be in that movie.
That is one of my favorite films. That's the big main brand film that I was in. I think that was the third film I did. I did a movie right before it called Tough Luck with Amanda Sante and Norman Reedus, who then became famous for being Daryl. But yeah, Big Fish was a really fun experience, and an interesting experience. I have memories because it almost got me killed.
Oh, wow.
So if you remember in the movie, I get rolled out in a box. The box then blows up. I jump out, do a fire blast. Then I get fired by Danny DeVito. So the box was built with, I'm trying to think of the type of wood it is. It's the stuff you use to make model plane, wooden planes. It's very light wood, balsa wood.
Okay.
And it was scored inside, so it's all cut up. There's holes drilled into it with wires jammed into it. And there was this giant device that was pulled taut in the air. And then when it was time, the springs would unload and they would pull apart and the box blows up. So that's how they made it. And then the stand I'm in would shoot some powder and some debris in the air. And so it looks like I blow the box up. Well, they had me inside the box holding a torch that's lit on fire. And I told them, well, you know, if you have me in this box and all four sides, the roof and the bottom are sealed, when this blows up, there's going to be a problem. And they're like, oh, what's going to happen? I said, it's going to cause a vacuum and the fire is going to cause a, we'll do a fireball around me. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, yes, I do. It's also physics. I've learned it in science. That's what's going to happen. Well, we tested it. Well, I saw the test they did. The person did not have a fire torch in their hand. They were just in the box and nothing happened to them. We get to the day of the filming. I tell them again, I don't think this is a good idea. They told me I'm wrong. I went fine. I had the torch in my hand, but something told me put my hand over. I closed my eyes as tight as I could and brought my hand up. But if you look at the show, I have no eyebrows.
Yes, I noticed that.
It's because the fireball went around me and singed my hair.
Oh my gosh.
I'm standing there with no torch because it blew the torch out. I'm shaking, but standing in the box, on the box. And I'm like, and I have a mouth of fuel. So I spit the fuel when they say cut. I just stand there because around me, we have probably around 100 extras in the stands. And I don't think it'd be a good idea for a 7-foot giant screaming, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, with the audience there. So I just stand there. Tim comes up and I'm still standing on the stand. I haven't got off. And he goes, is there a problem? I said, well, yeah, if you noticed, I'm burnt. And he goes, what? And I said, fireball. And one of the stunt coordinators saw it too. That's why he was kind of quick to get to me. And he had walked up to me and says, did what happened happen? I went, yes. So he goes, are you okay? And I go, I don't know. I go, I'm afraid to move for fear of falling because I was in shock. So we got me off the box. He walked off another direction to have it. He goes, okay, reset the scene. He went out one side, the stunt coordinator and two other stuntmen that I had already been hanging out with at the hotel kind of gathered around me and just told me, was just talking to me, but basically had their hands on my back to make sure I didn't fall. And I just got the heck out of that tent. And we walked out front. By the time I got to the exit, Tim Burton was there. Asked me questions. I said, well, this is what happened. The FX people go, well, you know, we didn't think that would happen. And he goes, and then they were acting like I didn't bring it up either. And I was like, well, I go, if my hand, I go, if we don't close the, I go, where you have the cameras, there's no cameras on the back of the thing. Why have the back closed? Leave the back open. I'll hold my hand out with the torch. It'll be out of that zone. It should be okay. Also, please, I go, what type of powder and stuff is in the thing? And they go, oh, it's coconut, ground coconut. I went, oh, great, something flammable. That is also used by some fire breathers to do fire blasts. So we had them Nick's loading that in. We had them build the, put the box back together, put the new box on. They did not put the back end in. And then I did the whole thing, blew the blast. It looked beautiful. But if you watch the clip, you can see fire coming from the bottom of the box. They used part of the first attempt. And it looks beautiful.
Well, yeah, I was about to say, the scene looks great. And I mean, you would think, even though I'm sure there's egos, of course there's egos everywhere, but coming from somebody, because you are a fire breather, you're experienced, you know what you're talking about, that they you know, may have considered.
Yeah, you would have thought that, but no. they didn't. And so from then on, I've always been able to keep, I've stuck to whatever I believe in. If I start having discussions with people, I'm like, look, not to be mean, this is what I do for a living. I've done this so long. This is what's happened when I've done this and this. I'm not going to have that happen again. And if you want to do it, that's great, but it won't be with me.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say stand your ground. You know, that was, that could have been, so, that could have went even worse, really.
So it is one of the funnest things I ever did. Great experience, but at the same time, scared the pajavers out of me. That was the second time I was in the middle of a fireball, and I planned never to be in a third one.
Oh, God.
The first one was for Alice Cooper.
Oh, my God. Well, gosh, man, I had no clue. So we got to hear this now, George. All right, let's hear this.
Okay, so there is Alice Cooper basically did a miniature movie for a maze for like Halloween, a Halloween type maze. And they used it, and then they decided they wanted to add more to the film. And so basically it's a, he has a dream machine that he can go into people's dreams and scare the crap out of people. So his family or collective of people gather around while he does that. Well, I'm one of the family members, and I do a thing. I used to do an act called garden sushi, which is I eat live insects. And they came up with an idea. So they were going, well, we want to do something weird and different. And I was working on a show in Branson, Missouri, which was called Ripley's Live. And I was working with a guy named Todd Robbins, who has done a lot of weird sideshow stuff, true crime shows.
Yeah.
And he's a fire breather. So I was talking to him and saying, well, you know, if I soak my hand in water and I'm holding bugs in my hand, you could do a fire blast on my hand and I shouldn't get hurt. I wouldn't have my hand hurt because the water would absorb the protect, would be, because the whole purpose of fire eating is the moisture in your mouth acts as a barrier from the fire. So you you kill the oxygen before the fire can absorb all the moisture in your mouth. That's why you don't get burnt as bad as you, as people think you would be. So I figured if I had a wet hand, no problem. We tested it a few times. It worked great. I then went to do the thing with Alice Cooper in New York with my performance partner of the time, Michael Morena. We had a troupe called Shock Value. And We practiced a couple times. He did fine. The fire stayed around my hand. No problem. We shot that scene. They kept having us do it. And I think we did it 20 times.
Wow.
So that means he's done 20 blasts in a row, which really isn't fun. And so he was frustrated. And the last one he did, it didn't stay just around my hand. It went from behind my back to my hand.
God.
And so I was in the middle of the fire blast and I wasn't ready for it. So all of a sudden I see fire around my eyes and that freaked me out. And I threw the bugs in the air and I was like, we're done. We're done. Thank you very much. We've done filming. We will not be filming this stunt anymore.
First of all, that's crazy. Something that freaks you out. So that's, you know, you were eating bugs. And now the thing about, now I've had somebody on here before, actually had a magician, Tanya Solomon. She did a lot of sideshow stuff in her early days. And that's what she did. She would eat bugs. Now I got to ask you, because you brought it up, what kind of bugs were you eating?
Mealworms, waxworms, crickets, night crawlers.
Ooh.
And I and then from there, when I was working at an amusement park, the producer for Fear Factor saw me. So I supplied all the live insects for eating for Fear Factor for the first year and a half.
Oh my God, dude, that is so awesome. Okay, well, let me ask you this real quick. What do they taste like? What do the
earth... crickets have like a hickory taste. Same thing with the mealworms. It depends on what you're feeding them. There's a way to lessen the toxicity of the insect, of the taste. And that is, you can put them in cornmeal, let them sit in cornmeal for a few hours, and basically they'll eat everything out of it. So you could basically clean out bugs by just putting them in cornmeal for a while, and the bugs won't have any taste whatsoever.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Okay, well, let's do this, because so much, first of all, George, you've done a lot of cool stuff, brother. Really, you have. Now,
see, that's something I don't really think I do, but then I listen to myself and go, oh yeah, that is kind of cool.
That's super cool, man. Dude, you, okay, first of all, what was Tim Burton like? Is he as strange in real life as he persona is?
Tim Burton was a pacer. It was when he was trying to figure something out, he would just walk back and forth. And it was very odd, but at the same time, you could see what was going on, that he was just working everything in his head, and he just needed a little bit of movement to get it to flow. And so once you realized what he was doing, it was like, it wasn't freaky, because I was like, okay, I've been in those situations where I'm trying to come up with an answer, and just sitting there is not going to do it. You got to move to just progress everything.
And you know what's so, once again, when I say super cool, you know, George, you weren't in just some shit movie. You were in a fantastic, very well done, artistic Tim Burton movie.
In my mind, it has nothing to do with me being in it. Anytime it shows up on TV when I'm flicking the channels, I will stop and watch it. I don't care where it is. It could be after my scene, before my scene. It's just one of those movies I enjoy watching. I also do believe, and this gets me in trouble, but it is one of the best live action shows he's ever done. I don't think any of the other ones are as good as this one. The only problem is not a lot of people know it as much as you think they should. I would think everyone would know it, but no, they don't. They know Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's of the live programs and stuff. Not as many people know this show as you would think they would. And it's a heartbreaking story. Anyone that has had any relationship with their father that's a little odd will relate to this and find themselves sitting there crying.
Definitely.
I saw it for the first time at a college in a film class. a friend of mine was working at a theater, and they had film classes come and bring movies in, and they would watch the films. They'd bring a lecturer in or whatever. And he found out Big Fish was coming in. So he calls me and he says, "Hey, I can get you it." He goes, "I can get like four or five people into the theater. Do you want to come?" And I'm like, "It's a 2-hour drive to go there." "Yeah, I'll be there." So me and my wife jumped in the car. We drove to LA. We found out like 2 days before the event. We drove to LA, saw the film with the writer who wrote the book. So he plays the science teacher in the movie.
Oh, okay.
And he has a little cameo. And so he thought it was great that I came all the way over there to see it, because he was like, I asked some question, because my part, what the circus wasn't in the book. And so I go, when you watch something like that, do you think, oh my gosh, they've changed my book that badly that they've added something? Or do you think it did help? And he was like, he goes, for the story they were telling, it really did help to have a little bit of the circus stuff. And so, and then later on, he was like, why do you look familiar? I go, because I'm the circus giant. Because I waited until after the college students left. And he was like, oh my gosh. And so we chatted a little bit longer, then me and my wife jumped in the car and drove home.
And you know, that's rare too for the author to admit something like that in the movie actually adds to the story. Well, this is the cool thing in the circus scene is that, you know, you were in a scene with Danny DeVito.
Oh my gosh. He can fire me anytime. He was a sweetheart. He was just he sat down and talked about Andy Kaufman and some other topics several times while just waiting. I got this really cool photo of him pulling a sword out, and he's standing on three apple boxes so he could do it. Later on, like a few years later, I ended up doing a movie called Perfect Strangers, where I was just hired to be basically a glorified extra. They wanted me because I could do something different, but I was basically being hired because they needed carnival folks in the background. So I got paid to be a little bit more than an extra. Well, he was one of the stars of the show, him and Kathy Bates.
Wow.
And so I brought the photo for him to sign, but I'm like, well, you know, I don't want to bother him. He probably doesn't remember who I am. And you're not supposed to, when you're an extra, you don't talk to the stars. It's just it's a written law somewhere, I think, because you're told that all the time. So I'm not going to bother him. I'm standing waiting for something. Danny walks by me, stops, stares at me and goes, "George, how are you?" And I'm like, how the heck does he remember my name? I can't remember people's names half the time. I know how many people this guy meets. How does he remember? And so we ended up chatting. We hung out. He took me to the dressing room. While we were walking to the makeup trailer for him to get made up, one of the workers runs up to me basically to yell at me for talking to Danny, that I'm bothering him. And Danny turns to him and goes, "No, George is a friend of mine." And in the back of my head, I'm going, Danny told him I was his friend. And I was like, I don't know. There was some side of me, some little child in me just running around going, "He said I was his friend." So yeah, it's...
I believe all of us would react that way, man. That's awesome. That is super awesome. I do know, like, whenever you are in entertainment, opportunities, things kind of pop up and happen, cool things that you wouldn't expect that you would get to do that you get to do. And it looks like Sideshow has opened a lot of doors for you, correct?
Oh, yeah. That's how I got into a few of the movies, was just because I do weird things. They wanted someone that could do this or that. And it's got me in the door. And it's like, you know, I that the first TV show I ever did was called The Strip. It was basically on UPN. It was Miami Vice meets Vegas. It was a very weird concept. I was doing a show at Universal Studios Hollywood for Halloween Horror Nights. And one of the people working with me was a contortionist, Bonnie Morgan. Bonnie Morgan, you might know who she is if you've seen the movie The Ring. She's the girl crawling out of the TV sets for the last couple movies.
Serious.
Also, if you watch Minority Report, she's the one that when he falls through the glass ceiling into the yoga studio, the girl that waddles up to him with her head between her legs and goes, that looks like it hurt. That was Bonnie Morgan.
Wow.
Her father, he was one of the brothers in Pete's Dragon. He's one of the bad brothers in Pete's Dragon.
Okay, cool.
Gary Morgan.
Cool.
So Gary Morgan received a phone call from one of his stunt coordinator friends looking for someone that could do something odd and menacing. And he goes, well, my daughter's working with a guy. And next thing I know, I have an audition. Next thing I know, I'm flying to Vegas during my couple days off and filming a TV show where I did a pincushion act, and I think I did some fire for it. And then later on, I do a stunt with the one actor. And it was just a weird, weird way to get introduced to film. Because the Morgans had taken me to an agent just to talk to him. And then 2 days later, I'm calling the agent going, hey, I have a TV show wanting me to be part of it. Can you be my agent? So I got an agent basically because I already had a job for him, and so he got me a good deal on that one. And then like a few weeks later, I ended up going to Utah to film Touched by an Angel, and I'm like thinking, well, this is how filming's supposed to be. You're just supposed to start working. And then I didn't hear anything for a while, and then I did Big Fish. I did a Tough Luck, then I did Big Fish. And since then I've done some TV shows here and there. But yeah, you get an impression thinking, oh my gosh, this is how it's going to work. And then you realize how being an actor really is of, yeah, you just sit and wait and hope to get cast.
It's a hurry up and wait kind of type.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. So, okay, well, let's talk about the sideshow.
Okay.
How long have you been doing sideshow performing, and what got you into sideshow?
Okay. I am 52 years old. I have been doing it since I was 21. I fell in love with sideshow when I was 12 years old. I saw the Sword Swallower and Fire Eater perform on the Bally stage. I was amazed at what the human body could do. In my mind, that's real magic, to control your body to do things that you shouldn't be able to do. Later on, I had done research on sideshow stunts, but never really did anything because when I was 8 years old, I started doing magic. When I was like 15, 17, I started doing escapes because to me that was real magic because you're controlling your body to do things. Then when I turned 21, an incident occurred in my life. I think I can tell this story here. Someone broke into my brother's home, tied him up, lit him on fire, and left him to die. He survived, but left him with a very strong fear of fire. I am very close to my eldest brother. It freaked me out and caused me a lot of stress. I'm one of these idiots. I'm scared of heights, so I bungee jumped, I decided I was going to learn fire eating. So I started doing research, and I basically started fire eating to overcome my fear of what happened to my brother. When you do that, you start finding manuscripts on different stunts. And it became the tattoo slash potato chip theory. Once you have one, you have to have more. So I started doing more research. I started contacting different sideshow performers that were accessible. This is at the time on the internet where there were discussion boards, and that was it.
Yeah, there wasn't much.
No, it was like there was a guy named Slim Price who was doing a thing, I think, on AOL or something, where you could ask questions, and because he had been in the sideshow for years and done stuff. Then a magician friend of mine, one of his close friends, used to work in a sideshow, so he taught me glass walking. And so I would learn a little bit here and there and do research on it and study it and figure out how it would work and how not to hurt myself. And so I started doing that a lot. And finally, I decided I was going to write a fire eating book. And because I didn't like what was out there, because they were telling you to use unleaded gasoline and all this other stuff that could just kill you. Some of it was done because that's what they were doing at the time. Other times they were doing it so you wouldn't do it. Houdini wrote a book about escapes, and if you followed half the things he said, you would kill yourself. He gave you answers that sound logical, but if you attempt them, you would find yourself in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And Sideshow did the same thing. Unless you were in it to win, in it and with it, and you were with the group, they're not going to just give you the information. So it's like, unless you're getting it live and having them walk you through it, it probably wasn't going to be the correct information. It would sound good and make sense, but just because it makes sense doesn't mean it's true.
Definitely. Now, and the sideshow community, were they kind of like welcoming though, once you kind of showed up with the interest, or was it tough to crack that shell?
Some yes, some no. I mean, you got to realize the sideshow community then was almost dead. You're dealing with the sideshows that were actually touring weren't, there was only like one or two touring sideshows. You had Ward Hall, and you had Bobby Reynolds, and Bobby Reynolds was basically retiring. Then you had Coney Island. And then you had, I think there was one other, but you had basically the only people. Oh, you had John Strong. He was touring. And so those were the only sideshows that were surviving at the time. And then this was right when Jim Rose showed up. And people, it brought a resurgent of the interest of this live art form. And it brought a lot of people to the party. So all these people started doing sideshow. It started to come down again. So I'm waiting for some other weird troupe to come out of nowhere that's going to make people go, oh my gosh, where has this been? But Jim, I watched a lot of footage from Jim Rose, and I worked with a lot of people that worked with him. You know, Jim was Jim, and he did a lot of things that I wouldn't do. I wouldn't treat people the way that I saw him handle his show. But is it a bad thing that he drew attention? No.
Well,
so it was like,
how was he doing his show? What was he doing? Like,
it was basically, it just basically, as I mentioned about an agent I had, he almost had reverse Tourette's. It was like every few words was a non-curse word. It was like, if you listen to his show, it's like, every word is a curse word. And I'm like, that's not me. I don't want that around me. My show can be played for any age. I can do a show at a bar and then 2 days later go to a library and basically do the same dang show.
That's funny, reverse Tourette's. It's like a show that's so filthy that you start noticing the clean words. You're like, whoa, yes. Did he just say shucks?
Yeah, I know a comedian that way. So it's like, yeah, it is what it is. I mean, it's not, I'm not saying it wasn't good for the time, because he was going for that type of crowd. He was going for college crowds and everything else. So he worked for that market. And with that, he got on Lollapalooza. And Lollapalooza was such a new thing. It brought in light all these bands that no one knew existed, and made Jim Rose a household name.
Absolutely. So there, he had his audience, and I think that's important for knowing your audience. But now, well, let me ask you this. Is there, because Sideshow being such a classic type of live entertainment, do you have, like you talked about, the next up and coming big name? I mean, how does that kind of work in the Sideshow market? I mean,
you know, okay, so you have a gentleman named Harley Newman, who has been doing this forever. You have Red Stewart. You have Todd Robbins. Todd Robbins and Harley Newman were doing this at colleges before Jim Rose did it.
Gotcha.
But they were doing it in a way where they had both of them are intellectual nutcases. They know anything and everything about the subject, and they're very knowledgeable. So when you watch their Sideshow, it's watching a college professor talk about the history of stuff. And I find it fascinating. I can never do that. I don't have my speech is not as eloquent as theirs. That's why my show is different. I am as a performer once told me, I am a Sideshow goofball. I fell in love with Sideshow when I was young. And when people want to talk about it, I get excited that they're talking about a topic that I like. It's kind of like talking to an 8-year-old about a superhero that he's excited about. He will ramble about it. He's so happy that you're interested in it. And that's the same way I am with Sideshow. And so I had worked on a troupe where they basically had me as a tall, silent guy. I never talked. I looked pissed off all the time. That isn't me. And so when I walked away from that troupe, I realized I'm a goofball. I know what I am. I'm 7'3". My body never really liked following my directions. So it's like, I'm a giant cartoon character on stage. I make stupid jokes. I talk about different things. And I make you forget that I'm doing a sick, twisted stunt. I get you laughing at something and then afterwards go, oh my gosh, he shoves a tube up his nose. That's the whole point of my show, is I want you to have so much fun, you don't realize anything I'm doing is gross until afterwards.
Now, okay, so you said you're 7'3". Let's back up here on the movie real quick, because I meant to ask you this. The other giant in the movie, now he has passed away.
Matt McGorry has passed, yes.
I heard he wasn't really that much taller than you in real life.
He was around 7'7", 7'8".
Okay, well.
But he was hunched over. I mean, he had giantism.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all his joints were messed up. He was what he was. He was a nice guy. I mean, As I tell everyone, when I have that expression on my face of, oh, crap, I've lost my job, it was just me reliving half the jobs I lost to that gentleman. Because we'd go to auditions, and he would beat me out of the job.
Really?
And it was just, oh, yeah, I lost like four jobs to him. And it was so, and I lost that job from him. I was up for Carl. And I had been told they were interested in me for Carl. And then all of a sudden I got told, no, we're now interested in this. We're going to change the way we had. Colossus originally was blown out of the box with a giant caveman club on his shoulder. When they found out I could do fire breathing and all this other stuff, they went, well, this would be better. So I got the part of Colossus. He got Carl. And, you know, I lost that part. And his part was bigger. But a lot of people remember me from, from the movie. It's a good... I mean, I'm only on screen for maybe a total of 5 minutes.
Hey, though.
That.
But it's still badass because it's a Tim Burton film.
It's a Tim Burton film.
You're in a scene with Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
So, hey, that's super cool. Hey. Okay, so now, okay, well, let's talk about this because kind of the obvious thing, probably you have probably, I'm assuming, you know, most of your life you have been a tall person.
Yeah.
And there's that normal pressure. Me, I'm a short dude, George. I'm 5'6" on a good day, folks. So, as a tall person, I would assume there's all these stupid expectations and things that are tossed at you, like you should play sports or you should do this. Did you get that kind of crap growing up?
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine, basically, I decided to finally play basketball because I had a friend just begging me to do it. And I'm not the coordinated guy. I'm not that good at it. And I really don't like sports. I have a line that I say, and it's such a true line in my heart, which is, when you're my size, you have two choices, play basketball or be a freak. And I hate sports.
But
I played basketball. I tried. I wasn't that good. And then I ended up having a motorcycle accident that messed up my knee. The coach got on my back for it, told me I had to sell my bike. And that when it comes to basketball, he was my god. And I basically told him, look, I don't get along with my dad, and he doesn't talk to me this way. You're not talking to me this way. There was just no way. It was like, the reason why I was riding a motorcycle is because I could afford a motorcycle. I couldn't afford a car. I didn't have the money for a car. So you're telling me, okay, well, I guess you should walk everywhere. No. I have a vehicle. Thank you very much. It's just not the vehicle you like.
I think you made a much better choice anyways. So being a freak.
I enjoy doing it. Yeah, you know, it doesn't always pay all the time, but when it pays pretty nicely sometimes.
And that's true too. But you know, another thing though is, but just when you look at the things that you've got to do and the experiences, you know, I think that's all worth it because at the end, one day when we're all, you know, old and crusty, we'll have some pretty decent stories to tell, you know?
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, I had the chance to go to Turkey for a television show. I've traveled all over the U.S. and Canada with sideshow troops. I've performed in movies, TV shows. I've got to meet people that I probably never would have met. I got to meet President Carter. Oh, I got to meet Alice Cooper. I mean, these are cool things to me. So it's like, you know, I might not have the money as so I have some friends that are very well off because of what they do. But, you know, I've got to do things that they haven't.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong. I have people that I grew up with that are making a lot more money than me, and they've done a lot more than me because, they're all in the band Korn. But that's a whole different story.
Oh, cool. You know Korn. That's the band Korn.
Yeah, me and Jonathan Davis grew up together.
Oh, that's super cool.
We were basically latchkey kids. His father was the music director at a community theater, and my mom did a lot of directing there. So him and me would be stuck walking, running around the theater while they were doing rehearsals.
Oh, man, that's good. See, George, you're just full of cool stuff, man. I tell you, okay, let me do this real quick. First, I want to say this. I know before we move off on Big Fish, like I said, my friend Jason, he's a big fan of the movie, and he has literally been to the place in Alabama where they filmed the movie. Is it?
Oh, yeah, they took him to the little island.
Yeah. And that's where your scene was filmed as well?
No, my scene was filmed on a sod farm.
Okay. Was that in Alabama too?
Yes, Alabama. Everything was filmed in Alabama, except the Paris scenes. They actually filmed in Paris, which makes no sense to me. because I looked at all that going, that could have all been done real easily somewhere else. I think it was just an excuse to use money or to get a free trip to Paris. Our scene, we were on a sod farm and it was raining. So it was like everywhere you walked, you were sinking into the ground.
Wow.
It was not a fun experience. I almost lost my shoes a couple times.
Okay. Well, let's do this real quick because you talked about you've done a lot of things, you've met a lot of people. And every entertainer that comes on the Abracadam podcast, we have to ask this question, okay?
Okay.
George the Giant, will you give us a hell gig story?
So I got called up by a gentleman who was trying to do a sideshow at a carnival in Kentucky. He begged me to do it. He flew me out. We got there. I looked at the stage. The stage was probably 3 feet wide by 6 feet long. And so it was a very tiny stage that we were going to be performing on. Didn't bother me. But the problem is when I do sword swallowing, I do a bent, I do a lean where I bend down towards the audience so they can see the sword going down the throat. And when I do that, I kick my foot out. Well, instead of a wide stage that I'm normally on, I'm on this less than 3 foot wide stage. I was in the center of it when I did the kick out. So in so doing, my back leg went off the stage and the rest of my body followed the leg while the sword was down my throat. So I fall backwards and basically land on my right foot. And I'm thinking I've just killed myself. I flicked the sword out. I went, thank you very much. And I ran out of the stage, out of the tent. The other performer saw it. He knew what was going on. The guy that hired me and stuff was outside. He's yelling at the one guy, why did he leave? Why did he leave? And he goes, dude, I think George has hurt himself. He's trying to make sure. So I'm like, I'm running to a restroom so I can see if I'm spitting up blood. Because I'm freaked out. Everything was fine. And then the guy turned to me and goes, well, you can't leave that tent unless I tell you you can, when I went back. And I was knocked the guy out. And the other performer and me became friends, and we both referred to that guy as a Nimrod. So, yeah, you know, we were both like,
that must have been terrifying.
It was one of the only thing that was physically, because I really didn't know if I had done something stupid. The only other time that I have been in fear of my life while performing is I was at Universal Studios Hollywood, and I was doing sword swallowing. And one of the things they tell you, if you see anything, one way you can tell when you're hurt is stuff shows up on the sword mixed in with the saliva and stuff. Well, I pull the sword out, and there's red chunks all over the sword. And I'm like, oh, crap, oh, crap. And then I remembered I had been sitting in the back room eating red vines. But at first, I didn't. And the guy with me, we're both looking at the sword like, I just killed myself. And then I grab a piece and realize, oh, no, it's licorice. And I walk off the stage, and he's all mad because he's like, you scared the crap out of me. I'm like, you? I scared you. I scared myself. Shut up. And so, yeah, now I won't eat red licorice when I'm performing because that's a bad thing.
Gosh, that's so weird because you don't think about, you know, when you eat stuff like that. Then, but, God, that's just weird. The and sword swallowing, man. I mean, that's a real okay. We all, you know, being a magician, of course, we all know the
collapsing sword or the rolling one, yeah.
But the real doggone deal, man. I mean,
it goes straight down the throat. It goes down the throat between the lungs. It nudges the heart slightly to the side because then it drops into the stomach. I mean. People get hurt. I mean, I tell people this is dangerous. And if you don't believe me, one of my friends, while at Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, we were doing a show. He punctured his lung. I ended up having to rush him to the hospital. A few years back, while performing at Ripley's in Hollywood, I punctured my esophagus. I ended up in the hospital for 4 days on an IV drip. You know, that's scary as all get out. Ended up in a hospital. I was like, I've been so paranoid ever since that it's like, if I start putting the sword down and it doesn't feel right, I pull it straight out and go, okay, we'll try it one more time. If I feel the same way, I'm like, sorry, I'm not swallowing a sword. And I go to something else because I'm like, I'm not going to hurt myself. I refuse to die for my art.
Okay, well, let's do this. Speaking of your art, now, mostly, George, I ask magicians this question, okay? But I thought, you know what? This could, you know, we cross over to sideshow performers. It definitely can, okay? So this is a thought-provoking question. All right, George, are you ready?
Okay.
All right, let's say that you wake up and you realize you are stranded on a desert island, but then you also notice there's 1,000 spears being pointed at your throat by the indigenous people that live on this island. You, George, have to choose one sideshow act, stunt, to do for these people to convince them that you, sir, not only are a giant, but also a god. What do you do?
That would be a strongman stunt, and that would be putting the tip of the spear on my throat and breaking the spear staff.
Holy
which
crap.
I've actually done.
You do that? Wow.
I do it with a piece of rebar, but I have a friend that was doing it with a spear tip, and so I did it one time just to see if I could do it. And to me, it was a little nerve-wracking. I mean, the tip of the spear is rounded a little bit, so it's not like a sharp point, but you can feel that going into your throat when you're bending the staff, and when it snaps, it is such a weird feeling.
Gosh. So how do you learn other new routines and acts and stuff? Do you just, meet someone to teach you?
Well, that, and so one of the things I got known for is the human crazy straw, which is the tube is threaded through wrapped around an audience member, then up my nose, out my mouth, into a container of milk, and then I drink it. I did on America's Got Talent and some other shows. It came to be because I was already doing a thing called Balloon Trick, which Todd Robbins was famous for, where it's one of the twisting balloons. You make a small bubble, and then with the other end, it threads through your nose, out your mouth, and you squeeze it, and the bubble goes back and forth on either end of the balloon. Mm. So I'd been practicing that. And then I was also doing a stunt called gavage, that Matt the Tube Crowley created from the Jim Rose sideshow, which was he had a giant cylinder and a tube attached to it. The tube would be threaded through the nose into the stomach cavity. Then they'd pour 20 to 30 ounces worth of liquid into the container. They'd put a plunger into the container and push all the liquid into his stomach, then pull it back out and pour it in cups.
Oh, my God.
So I had been doing that stunt and crazy straw and balloon trick for a while. Well, I was sitting at a Bob's Big Boy, and some kid was screaming at his parents about not getting a crazy straw with his meal, because that was part of the meal at the time, is they had a crazy straw. And I said, oh my gosh, that would be so funny. Next thing I know, we're at a Home Depot the next day getting tubing, and I'm prepping it and doing crazy straw. And it's formed the way it is now. Other people are now doing the act. Some are doing it very well. Some of them, I wish they wouldn't do it because it looks horrible. But, you know, everyone has the right. I mean, do I feel it was stolen? As long as they're not using all my jokes that are attached to it, I don't get that mad. Because I'm probably doing something that someone else did. A lot of sideshow stunts were based off of other people. So you can't get mad every time someone does something similar to you.
But I think it's important for the performer to put their personality into what they're doing.
Yes, well, it's the same thing with magic.
Exactly, yes.
You know, how many times can you watch The Linking Rings? Unless someone can give a version of it that makes it entertaining.
Yes, yes. Make it your own. Find a way to make it your own.
So now I have a question that might end this conversation really quick. Do you do the floating table in your act?
No, I do not. No.
Okay, then I'm allowed to keep talking to you because, you know, I just did an event that there was four different magicians, and they all did the floating table. I remember when it was so expensive, only a handful of people were doing it. Now it's like everyone and their dead dog Rover is floating a table, and they're all doing it the same way with the same storyline.
Absolutely.
Put something on it so there's a reason the table is there.
You know, I'll say this because my biggest frustration, absolutely, as a magician, to be honest with you, I don't watch a lot of other magicians. Really, I don't. Everything in my act is either believe it or not, it's original to me, or the effect I have took and made my own. So, yeah. You know, like in magic, you're not going to create a new effect because it's based off the laws of physics, you know, but you can take a classic and put your twist on it. And another thing is, when I do see these clones, they're all doing the floating table. It's, you know, I look at that and I'm just, there's no art in that for me, you know.
Well, my favorite thing is one of the effects that Penn and Teller did on a TV show, and they were doing it in their show in Vegas, is based on a trick that comes with almost every magic kit when you were a kid. But unless you know what's going on, you would not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people don't realize them producing goldfish and coins out of a fish tank is very similar to a trick of producing a silk in a glass.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And no one realized, and I go, that's almost in every magic kit when you were a kid, it came that way. And they're making this huge trick that causes such great reaction and emotion from something that most kids look at and they won't even do that trick because they think it's cheesy. But they turned it into something glorious.
You know, and that's what separates an artist, I think, from somebody just up there, you know, being a clone of something or another. And Unfortunately, we do have those people. I mean, you've got those people in pretty much all forms of entertainment, you know, but magic has that dark cloud over it as one of these things that you can go out and purchase your act. And, you know, like I said, for me, that was, you know, of course, I believe when you begin, you always want to, you see somebody you look up to and you're like, this is how I want to be them. And maybe for a few performances, that's who you try to be until you learn how to be yourself.
Well, it's kind of like, so I was doing magic when I was 8 years old. And when you buy a trick, it always came with instructions on how to do it and then patter. Mm-hmm. How many kids really went to the far eastern parts of China to get the mystic rice bowls?
Yeah.
That was the spill. And so you had all these kids saying this, and you're like, you've never left your block. Yeah. But the reason patter is with instructions is not for you to do that continually. It is to give you a comfort zone of learning how to say something, learning a script. And then from there, you come up with your own script. And that's what some magicians don't understand. They see one magician do it and go, oh, this is the way it needs to be done. No, you could use some of the concepts, but you need to then turn it into what works for you. As I stated before, I love Todd Robbins' act. I think the way he talks about the history of sideshow, he sounds like a college professor. He looks like a college professor, and I'm not. So me to do his act doesn't work.
Exactly, exactly.
Do I have some of his ideas in my show? Yeah, I do. I use a lot of his concepts. I use ideas and then try to form them to work for me. And I think as an entertainer, that's what we need to do, is realize that we all have an individual voice. And the thing is, that's what we need to put into our act. You can get an idea from one person, but you need to change it so you're not doing their... I got accused of stealing his lines. And so I was so paranoid. I went through my whole show, and anything that I said that he has ever said in a show, I yanked out.
Yeah.
And I ran into him, and he saw one of my shows, and I told him the whole story, and he starts laughing, and he's like, he goes, if you say this word, he goes, this was stolen from this. This has been being used in Blockhead for so many years. Everyone expects you to say this word or that, this line or that line. He goes, it's not that big of a deal. But he goes, I'm very glad you don't use this or this. So it was like,
well, you know, I think there's something, you know, of course, everyone has a stock line or two that they throw out and use, you know. But with my show, one thing that I do is I do stand-up comedy mixed with magic, and my bits and my tricks will connect. So technically, you can't steal my act without being me. It just wouldn't make sense, you know.
Well, so, there's the famous Harry Anderson bit.
Exactly. Hey, amen.
It's my name is Harry, but aren't we all?
Yeah.
And some magician used, hi, I'm Tom, but aren't we all? Harry, also meaning hair all over the body. So that's one of the famous comments of, you know, not every line is going to work. And some lines are going to work for who wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, have you ever heard of Gazzo? Street magician, street performer?
I think so.
He's one of the most famous street performers working today. One of the most, good God, one of the best entertainers I've ever seen. But he is also probably the most ripped off magician when it comes to original line. I can't say all his lines were original because he's been street performing for you know, yeah, who knows how long. But he did have some really great lines, and everybody tried to copy. Well, even his act, they were trying to be Gazzo, you know, and it was just, you know, this is how sad it is, George. There was American street performers actually faked a British accent when they did their street show just because it's because Gazzo.
Yeah. Oh, no, there's a few people that have taken people's acts. I mean, there's video of two magicians in Japan doing Penn and Teller's rocket ship.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And there's people that, because they think, oh, we're in a different country, we can get away with doing this.
Yeah. It don't count over here. We can do it. Yeah. Yeah. That's that type of attitude.
And you also get it of, I'm in a different state, so it's not going to really matter.
Yeah. That's,
and I've had that because I had someone send me a video of someone doing Crazy Straw using my lines. And so I sent a letter to the person saying, hey, I don't know if you're realizing what you're doing. And I sent a link to my video showing that I've been doing that line in this show for so long. I said, I would prefer if you don't use it. And I got the answer I got back is, well, you're not from here, so it doesn't matter.
Oh my God, that's BS.
And I was like, well, thank you very much. I'll make sure all my friends know that in your area. And then he goes, well, what do you mean by that? I said, oh, trust me, you'll find out. And he was like, you can't threaten me. I'm like, I'm not threatening you. I'm just telling you what you've just done is not a smart thing, because I know other performers that you tell other performers that you're being screwed up, and they see that other performer, they're going to tell them every time, going, stop doing this. And sure enough, he had like four or five people that would see him in street performances and say, you need to really stop doing the giant stuff. And, he was freaking out that I had people that would come up to him. And I'm like, you know, I'm not that popular. Not everyone knows who I am. But in the sideshow world, more people know who I am than not.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I've been around for 30 years.
Any way that you can use to protect your stuff like that, I say go for it. And you know, that's what we do. I mean, if you steal jokes and steal lines and steal acts, we're going to tell people, and the word's going to get out that you're a thief and that, you know, you're a hack. That's a hack. What was that?
No, nothing. I would never say his name.
Well, let's do this real quick. Let me ask you one more question before we get out of here. I just thought of this. And actually, I heard this question asked the other day, and I thought, you know what, man, I'm going to ask George this question. Real simple question, but it's kind of interesting when you think about it. If you could travel in time, George, would you, and you could only do it once, okay? If you could travel in time and you can only go one trip, would you go to the future or would you go to the past?
You know, that's a weird thing, because if you go in the past, the problem is the way the world is going right now, I think the future might only be a few more years. The past, it's because, do you really want to change? Are there things that I would want to change in my life? Yes, but the thing is, some of those things that happened in my life changed me in a way that I don't want those things to change. So it's like, if I could go in the past, it would probably be a completely different timeline. So it doesn't affect me at all, but gives me a whole new world of experiences.
That would be cool, because, man, you've had some pretty cool experiences.
Because I would want to be in an area where I would have a whole different set. Because as I said, learning is half the fun. It's like, when I did Sideshow, the reason why I had the potato chip theory was so strong with me is because it was learning how to overcome the puzzle, how to make something work, how not to get hurt, how to jump on glass and not have your foot blow up in blood. how to put your hand in an animal trap, how to light firecrackers off your chest. You just had to learn and figure it out. And you had some people helping you and other people that weren't going to give you a clue. So you had to figure it out yourself.
Well, I tell you what, I think I'm kind of with you. I think I would go to the past. I definitely wouldn't jump in the future. You know, I'm not that interested in the future. But, well, I tell you what, before we get out of here, is where can the listeners maybe catch a show from George the Giant or anything new, anything happening?
I don't have an agent anymore, which is pretty pathetic. I still get called up and I'll still do shows here and there. GeorgeTheGiant.com. I need to revamp the website again. On Facebook, I'm there, but I also have a pop-up museum called George the Giant Strange Museum of Oddities and Wonders. Since I've been performing for 30 years, I've been collecting stuff for almost 25. So I have like two-headed animals. I have carvings on matchsticks. I have dryer lint portraits. I have portraits in blood. So I have all these weird collections. Right now it's at a haunt in Orange County while I'm performing at Knott's Scary Farm. But it is, that museum has traveled to different locations at different times. And I'm hoping to turn it into a traveling museum that I go to different places for a few weeks and then move on.
That, you know, actually I saw something about that. I don't know if you posted a picture the other day, but that was the creepiest ass doll I've ever seen in my life.
I have a few dolls that are haunted. yeah. And they make me creep out. And the biggest thing is I don't believe in haunted objects, but they make me uncomfortable.
I don't know. There was just, I even showed it to my wife, Antoinette, and she was like, oh my gosh. And I was like,
I think you're talking about Laura Ann. If it's the one that looks very similar to the talking Tina in Twilight Zone,
that's
Laura Ann. She was found in a box in Fraser Park, buried in a box with incense, sage, and some other stuff, with a note basically saying, if you found her, you were her caregiver, and that you needed to protect her and be there for her. And you could only give her away if someone asks for her. And basically the person that found her was a doll maker of all things. And she said that the doll would appear in different parts of the house. She blamed her kids. Her kids kept saying they didn't do it. Then a lady in Arvin came over to get a doll made, saw her and said, oh my gosh, she's so interesting. And they went, great, you like her? Merry Christmas, and gave it to her. Some of the same things were happening, would appear in different parts of the house. My wife went to get some stuff. Next thing I know, the doll's at my house. I do not find any of the haunted crap scary about her. It's because she reminds me of the doll from the Twilight Zone that I do not want her looking at me. And my wife had her sitting in the front room in a place where it was like staring at me when I sat in my chair. And I was like, she needs to go. And so she went into the museum and then I have like Donnie, the ventriloquist figure who belonged to a couple that couldn't have children. And it's so funny because I was given the story, and it all of a sudden goes, you know, that's the same story as the boy. And I'm like, okay. I go, I've never saw the movie. I can just tell you the story and I can tell you what's happened while I've had Donnie in my possession. But I go, you know, my whole viewpoint on haunted objects and stuff is the same thing I have with voodoo. I don't believe in voodoo, but I don't kick a voodoo priest in the shins. No. I show respect. I put if I'm told to put hex bags underneath objects with sage and everything else, I do, because it doesn't hurt me to follow the rules.
There you go, man. Well said. Well, I tell you what, George. Well, man, this has been awesome, dude. So many cool things we talked about.
This interview went longer than I thought we both thought it was going to be. So I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. This is great, man. Hell, I could talk to you forever, dude. This is, you got a lot of cool stuff. But so Not Scary Farms is where you're at right now. So
I'm there until the end of the month. The 31st, okay. I leave.
Okay. And they can check it out at georgethegiant.com, you said?
Yep.
All right, man. Well, George, once again, thank you so much for coming on the Abracadam podcast. This has been awesome. Thank you.
No problem. You have a good one.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode with George the Giant. Man, I know I did. Some of the just very interesting stories, some little behind the scenes things, stuff like that. I love that kind of stuff. If you guys haven't seen the movie, go watch Big Fish. It's a Tim Burton movie. George, like he said, he's only in it for like 5 minutes, but once you've listened to this and you watch the movie, you will definitely see George. So if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. And if you want to learn more about George the Giant, you can go to georgethegiant.com and learn a lot. Maybe you can catch one of his sideshow performances. I highly recommend it. Also, if you guys have not done so yet, please follow and subscribe to the Abracadam podcast wherever it is you listen to podcasts, whatever platform, I don't care. Subscribe, follow, give us a comment. If there's an episode, a particular episode that you really liked, be sure to give us a comment. I would love to hear it. Also, I want to give a shout out to Australia, France, Canada, Tanzania. If I didn't mess that up, guys, I'm so sorry, but I see you. So, like always, Abracadamits, thank you for listening.
Yes, awesome. Let's rock and roll.
Abracadamits.
Let's rock and roll. Oh, Danny, will you please stop drinking vodka? Kid's birthday party?